This is one of these great user interfaces where it matters how long you push the button, and it's really quite funny. All right, in light of the fact that people are out this week, here's what I'm going to do about midterm. I've been asking myself what's sort of the least invasive way to do it, for reasons we've already talked about. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to basically hand it out tomorrow, what I'd like to do is hand it out tomorrow and basically say, bring it back Monday and do it as a take-home. My concern is that if I do that, then people who are out today may have difficulty getting the midterm, because I, for my part, will not be in Thursday or Friday. My sister is getting married on Sunday, which is great, but I have to go up because, of course, we're part of the family, and that's, you know, there's all this stuff before a wedding when you're part of the family. The bad news is that my sister neglected to consult the conference schedule, and a consequence of her wedding is that I will not be able to be at a conference in England that starts Monday morning. I'm actually a little annoyed about that, but, you know, the wedding's more important. I would just like to be at the conference. So is it possible that someone could arrange to make sure that everybody who's not here tomorrow actually can get a copy of the midterm? You know what, I could just post it online. Right, that makes more sense. Okay. Does that seem reasonable? Okay. Good. So, I've been grappling with how to start in on sort of moving up the food chain here a little bit and talking about how do you start building a system on top of a microkernel. And I keep thinking I'll get to that in the next lecture. And each time I think I'll get to that in the next lecture, I have another round of discussion with the herd people. And, you know, on the one hand, this is terrible because we're not getting there. But on the other hand, it's good because they're pointing out to me things that I've failed to cover that actually you want to know before you try to design application-level things. So in particular, we're having a discussion, the discussion really now is actually petering out, starting to slow down. But a couple of things have come up that have to do with system structure. And two of the topics that have come up, have been this issue of sharing, or some of the topics. How much sharing is okay? And the particular context in which this has come up is the context of how do I design object servers? What's the dividing line between the object and the server? Where should it be? What are the issues? Depending on your choice. Storage accountability, which we've talked about, but there's a piece of it that I didn't emphasize, so I want to come back to that. And still more issues that come from, I never spelled this word correctly, asymmetric trust. Why I'm a computer scientist and not an author for a living. I can't spell. The thing I want to say about, look, we've been through most of the discussion about storage management, okay? And the argument here is, look, you may not want a quota system in your overall system design, but you have to have one. The question is not, do you have a mechanism for imposing a quota? The question is, do you have a policy for imposing a quota? I mean, there are only so many resources to go around, and even if you don't want to charge me for them, or you don't want to say to me, I have to stop at a certain amount, you still need to know where those resources went, because at the very least, you need to know when you're going to run out. Okay. So even if you don't have a policy that says Schaap only gets 5 pages, on the theory that there's a limit to how much damage I can do with 5 pages. Oh boy, is that optimistic. But even if you don't actually want to say that, right, you still need to know systemically, look, I've got 5,000 pages and 4,999 of them are allocated and the next one's the last one I've got. Right, this is something you want to know. And furthermore, from a system management standpoint, if the system gets into trouble, right, if you suddenly discover all of your space is allocated, you know, you'd like to know where it went. Right? Even if only for the purposes of post hoc recovery. And so all of these things amount to, you got to keep track. And there was somebody on the hurt list who said they thought quotas were stupid. And for the most part, I think I agree. I think that I think that there are two ideas that people get mixed up. One is the idea of a quota, and the other idea is the idea of a reserve. Right. So there is a kind of a quota that I want, which is I want to make sure that if you mess up and you overcommit the system resources, or you run the system out to the wall, or you take over the CPU, or, and this may not even be hostility, right? It may, you know, people do write infinite loops, and it doesn't mean that they're out to get me, right? It's not personal. But if you manage to exhaust the available system storage, right, I at least want to know that I have enough storage left that I can run the administrative tool to find out what went wrong. And I haven't seen this come up with storage, but I have seen it come up with schedulers that somebody will set a really high priority task in motion. Lo and behold, it's got a bug and it ends up in an infinite loop. Okay, and you can't even log in to find out what's going on because this task has higher priority in the system logging agent. I mean, I actually have had occasion to try to debug a problem where it literally took us 6 hours to get enough idle cycles into the login agent that we could successfully log in to find out which process had taken over the world. And we didn't want to kill the machine because we wanted to know what had gone wrong. But this is, you know, this is just obviously not okay. Now the solution to this, in some sense, is the inverse of quotas. When we think about quotas, we usually think about a maximal limit on allocation. But in fact, what we do want, in some sense, is a minimal guarantee of allocation for certain kinds of administrative tasks. There are quota systems that have both a min notion and a max notion, but when we think quota, we're thinking about limits, not guarantees, usually. There's a second place where a quota may be appropriate, okay? Which is not the situation that I want to say, hey, 600 pages, that's it. At 601, you know, your process is fired and you're out of here. Okay? I mean, not that scenario, because frankly, I don't know how to say whether the right number, in general, whether the right number was 600 or 602 or 4 million. I mean, we actually, in general purpose software, don't have that good a handle on the amount of resource we're going to need. So the problem with a hard quota system is it's not effective. Right? What happens is people say, well, I don't really know what it means. I'll give it something I think is enough. And if it fails, I'll give it some more. Right. And the reason we get away with this is we have so much overcapacity in our disk systems, right, that it's not insane to say, look, I'm going to fire up the web browser, I'm going to start an ActiveX control, I'm going to just give the ActiveX control a gigabyte of my disk. Right? Most of the time, it's really not going to use that. Once in a blue moon, it will. And frankly, if it wants more than a gigabyte of my disk, the answer is tough. But this is not a story motivated by any concept of what the application actually needs to do its job. Right? It's motivated by our notion of when the application has just ceased being reasonable and it's now behaving ridiculously. Right? It has to do with our views, not with what's actually required. Now, the problem with this is if it's an ActiveX control and the consequence is the ActiveX control fails, what happens? Well, you say, oh, you know, actually, I did want to play that movie, right? Maybe I'll raise the bar, and next time I'll let it have twice as much. And, you know, and after a while, most of my movies will work, right? You know, and once in a blue moon, there will be a movie that doesn't work, and the chances that I'll download that one are approximately zero. You know, and at this point, we have kind of a working system, sort of. But this model doesn't work so well when what I have is a long-running task where I actually care about the result. Right? For example, this model would not work so gracefully for a database where I haven't got a clue who is going to do the record insert that's going to push the database off the wall. But I do know this guy, Murphy. Okay? And what Murphy tells me is, whichever process it is that does this, that's going to be the last process on Earth that I want to have fail. Right? This is just a law of nature, right? The attacker isn't out to get you, but Murphy is, and it really is personal. Okay. So, this notion of quotas is kind of a crazy notion. And I think, operationally, what I sort of want is, and I haven't thought about this a lot, but, you know, just from a day-to-day operational standpoint, what I kind of want is something where I say, look, you know, above this threshold, either something's wrong, or I need to really reassess the situation, okay? And I want to get told, and maybe, and this is the part I haven't thought about, and maybe the right strategy is not to say, no more pages, shame on you. Maybe that's not the right answer, right? Maybe there are two other possible answers. One is to say, well, you'll allocate this next page, maybe, but it's going to take a very long time because we're not going to let it happen until we check back with the party providing the storage, which, that is to say, with me, the user. Another possibility would be to say, well, okay, here's a compromise. We don't really want to halt the database dead in its tracks. This often turns out to be an unfortunate outcome because it's in mid-transaction. It's actually really important that the allocation fail, if only so that the transaction can fail, if only so that I can then query the database to find out what the hell's going on. So just parking this transaction in the middle is actually not a really satisfactory solution. Maybe what we want, and I haven't thought this through, maybe what we want is a combination of notify me that something's going wrong and then start a work slowdown. Right? We're going to let the allocator continue, right? But we're going to put a rate limit on allocation. You're still going to be able to allocate storage, but you're going to do it slowly. So progress will get made, but not fast enough to really hurt us. And at some point, we're just out of storage, and we're going to have to do something about that. I have very mixed feelings about this sort of work slowdown kind of approach, because I think what it tends to do is obscure problems that in the limit are unavoidable. But I don't have a principled story for how to set a hard limit that makes sense. Okay. So I think you need accountability for storage even if you don't do quotas, whether or not you do quotas. Clearly you need it if you're going to do quotas. So here's a question. Should storage pools be first class? Now, what I mean by storage pool is the mechanism used to allocate storage. In Eros, it would be the space bank and other systems. There are other mechanisms. Some of them are, you know, sort of explicit in the sense that you can actually point at one and say, yes, that's the resource that is the storage pool, and that's the thing I allocate from. Maybe there's some convenience features, but all of those convenience features ultimately trace their allocation back to some particular storage pool. What I mean by first class is indeed this question of, can you actually point to the storage pool? So here's a counterexample. In Unix, when you grow your heap, right, the system has to allocate a new page. At least. And it may allocate several, but certainly it's got to allocate one. And it takes that page from the swap area, conceptually. And in fact, on most Unix systems, there is a mechanism to limit the total number of pages the process will be allowed to allocate. Look at uMinute in the manager. By the way, it's usually disabled. But this mechanism is not first class. There's no resource you can go to and say, tell me what the allocation is from this resource. Right? It's really an attribute of the process. There's a per process counter. But it's not that there's a separate abstraction from the process that you can point to and say, that was the storage source. If you want to look at it a different way, you could say, well, yeah, there is a separate abstraction. It's the swap area. But there's no subdividable abstraction. Right? Swap area is the, ultimately, it's the global source of pages. Right? There's nothing in between one process and the global source that you can point to and say, ah, yes, this is the storage area. These five processes are taking stuff from that storage area. Yeah.
Are you attempting, is there a distinction being made between making the storage something which can be hung onto, passed around, and allocated sort of by a process versus the allocator being something that is first class? Because if I can pull storage from, say, the system, hang on to it, pass it to other people, now I've built an allocator.
I don't understand your question. I mean, first, I'm not sure what you mean by allocator.
The
allocator, in my mind, is the process. That's first class already. Do you mean something else by allocator?
I'm trying to get at the idea of if your storage is first class versus the storage pool being first class. If your storage is first class, then can you start passing around storage? And if you can hang on to storage,
okay,
then
this
someone
is,
could
okay,
build
I,
an allocator.
I now understand the question. Let me come back to this.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, let me clarify what I understand to be the question anyway. So I think what you're saying is there are two different discussions here. One is the storage itself first class? That is, after I do an allocation, is there something specific I can point to and say, that's the thing that I allocated? And not only could I point to it, but does the system then allow me to transfer it? Right? So I get a page, and now I actually really have some concretely expressed authority over this page, and I might transfer that authority to you, and now you and I both, in some sense, have co-equal access to this page. Right? That's first-class storage. Right? And separate from that, there's the question, is the pull first-class? Now, maybe one way to think about a test for whether the pull is first-class, you're trying to get your head around this notion of first-class, is if I hold authority to use a storage pull, right, is that a resource that I might transfer? That is, could I take my authority to use that storage pull, and assuming I have a channel view, could I hand you a capability to the same pool so that either of us can then allocate from that pool? So indeed, there's sort of two layers here, right? There's the storage layer, and then there's the aggregating layer. Is that what you're getting at? Okay. So indeed, in Unix, for example, I would be of the opinion that neither storage nor storage pools are first class. It is not the case that I can allocate a page in Unix and hand you authority on that page, except in a weird indirect way. Okay. And it's not the case that you and I can establish a pool of pages from which we are both going to allocate. Now, there is something kind of in the middle that's a little strange, which is I can create a file. Right. I can allocate resource that comes to be associated with that file. This is allocated globally. Right. I can then tell you the name of the file, and if you open the file, we can arrange to share at the file level of abstraction. But we aren't sharing at the page level of abstraction. Right? It's the aggregate that's first class, not the substructure. I agree that this notion of what we mean by first class is a little slippery, but is it, do
you think it's clear what I'm trying to get at for the moment?
So to paraphrase, what you mean by first class is something that a process can internally point to, not something that the system designer is looking at externally and can point to.
Certainly, if the system designer can point to it, that does not make it first class. What I mean by first class is it's a resource that is uniquely identifiable, nameable, and manipulatable in the same sense that any other system resource is by processes, if you will, because usually the process is the manipulator. Okay. Now, so should they be first class? Sorry, another question?
Yeah, so my intuition, well, so first class is the way we're talking about it, is totally separate from the decision of whether a storage pool is a first class, is able to make policy decisions about allocations and sending out. So first class, for me at least, wraps with it the intuition of this object making decisions separate from the process, which having the ability to make decisions separate.
First class has nothing to do with decision making, and it has nothing to do specifically with storage pools. Right. What we're asking are, what are the nameable and manipulatable resources in the system? So in Unix, a file is a first-class resource, but a sector is not. You can only talk about sectors by indirectly by talking about files.
Okay.
So the question on the table is, if we're going to have a mechanism for doing resource limits, or governing resource allocation, should that mechanism in fact be a first class abstraction? Should we be able to share the pool, not just the pages?
I can think of interesting and potentially useful things that you could do by allowing it to be first class, but it also seems like there's potentially a security problem in there somewhere, although I can't put my finger on exactly what it is. I'd have to think about it more and figure out what would and wouldn't be things you could get around.
Well, the security problem would be that I might hold access to a storage pool, and I might give it to you, and it might turn out that wasn't such a clever idea, and you might abuse it. And that would be the source of the security problem. But that's no different from any other resource.
Right, and that's something that, you know, I cannot hand it out, and it's not a problem if I don't hand it out, at least theoretically. But
isn't that also true for every other resource? I mean, is there a new problem here that has to do with the fact that it's a storage pool? Or is it just generically that resources have to be handled with care and responsibility if you care about security?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
One potential usage for having a separate first class objects is if I'm running two different operating system layers on the same system, and I want processes that they spawn off and create to be allocated using these separate storage pools, then I might want to, at bootstrap, give each of them a separate one which they can pass to their children.
Okay, that argues that my notion of storage pool should be subdivisible. And I agree with that statement. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we require a first-class notion. Right? We could do that in some indirect sense, by associating processes with pools, right, but not actually having a descriptor. Although at that point we're teetering on the edge of it being first class, and then the real question is, so why didn't we just use the uniform mechanism that we already had for dealing with resource sharing? Sometimes the answer is, it was a late added feature to its design, and it just didn't fit the way the system had been done. Okay, I would suggest it has to be first class. And the reason they have to be first class is it goes beyond major subsystems.
Right.
I want to structure applications as collections of processes. And the reason I want to structure applications this way is I want to have units of failure that are smaller than the entirety of the application. And if I'm going to do that, right, what are the tools that I have? Well, my unit of failure boundaries are closely related to my protection boundaries. So if I want to create an isolatable unit of failure, right, my mechanism is in the OS level is I'm going to create another process. But that doesn't mean that I want the storage for that process to be accounted for separately. That's an orthogonal decision. So it's, I would argue, necessary, structurally necessary, to be able to set up situations in which multiple processes can use a common pool of storage. Furthermore, suppose I'm interacting with some service. Now, this service is not mine. It's a service that exists that does something for me, but it's not something over which I have control. And it might be that one of the things that it does is it builds things for me. I'd like to have the option now from the perspective of the service designer to say, yes, I will build things for you, but I won't pay for them. Right? The service I provide is assembly, but you pay for the materials. Right? When was the last time you saw a building contractor say, yes, I'll build the building and I'll just throw in all the materials, right? Right. This is like when you go to a car vendor and they tell you something's free, right? What that means is it's built into the price already. Okay. Either way, you're going to pay. The only question is, are you paying up front or are you paying indirectly? Okay. So I think we would like to be able to say, here is a source of storage, build something out of this. Yeah.
Another reason for this would be, let's in Unix, if you have only one global entity from which you can allocate storage, you can write a program that has a fork bomb.
The what?
That has a fork bomb.
A fork bomb. Oh, you can do things much simpler than fork bombs. But that's a separate issue from whether this needs to be first class. So what you're saying is we need limits because in the absence of limits, we have a denial of resource issue.
But the thing is, if you have a first class pool, then you can say if you fork, you can only use it from your pool.
And sooner or later you run out. Yeah. So, but that's not about whether the pool is first class. That's about whether you have a limiting mechanism. Right? We can imagine subdivisible mechanisms that would not be first class. But I agree at that point we're teetering on the edge of what we mean by first class. Yes, Scott.
Can we imagine subdivisible storage pools with different policy that are not first class?
Okay, we're now pushing on the first class notion harder than is useful. It's not intended to be a rigorous notion. So what Scott asks is, could we imagine a subdivisible scheme in which different storage allocators could implement or impose distinct policies? And the answer is, well, you know, I can imagine 19 impossible things before breakfast, but frankly, I think that wouldn't be the right thing to build.
That's my argument.
All right, and what we're actually teetering on here, and I'll get to your question, what we're teetering on here is that it's actually very imprecise what should be the test of when a thing is first class. Right. Another approximate test would be to say, well, can I talk about a storage allocator or whatever it is I'm going to talk about, right, without having it be somehow inextricably related to something else? Right. So in Unix, I can't talk about sectors. Right? I can only talk about them in the context of their relationship to a file or a file system. And I can't talk about them separately. Okay.
Yeah. Two questions. For one, if there's only one storage pool for a particular kind of...
Yeah, we're done talking about robust systems. Sorry, go ahead with your question.
No, would you still need that to be first class?
If there's only one storage pool?
For that, like CPU cycles, for example,
Okay, so any design where you have one storage pool in the entire system What you're saying is you don't want any controls.
One storage pool for a kind of resource, not for everything.
Any time where you have a kind of resource for which there is only one storage pool in the system, what you're saying is you don't have any controls. There's a fixed number of resources in a given system. If you have only one pool, there's only one sensible number of resources to put in it, which is all of them. Right? What it means to have only one pool for a given resource is that's the global pool. All right? I mean, necessarily. Maybe we'll take some out, you know, for kernel use or something like that. But for user purposes, that would be the global pool. Right. So, okay. There's another sort of interesting property if you have a first-class resource pool, which is there's an issue that is very, very hard to talk about, because we don't have a rigorous way to talk about it. Norm Hardy has coined the term durability to talk about this property. And what he means by durability is, in fact, Mark Miller and I were debating what he meant by durability, and what I think he means by durability is if I hold a resource that's constructed out of some storage, what guarantees do I have, or what contract do I have, at least, can I even express the contract, about how long it will continue to exist? Does storage allocated by my process go away when the process goes away? If it exists and you hand me an object built out of the storage, under what conditions can that storage be revoked? And I've previously argued very strongly against reference counting. And if we're going to do an explicit storage pool, one of the things we're going to have to be able to do is destroy a pool. And if that pool, in some sense, owns the storage that it has allocated, destroying the pool is generally going to have to mean reclaiming that storage forcibly, explicitly. What I want to point out, it's not that we have solved the durability problem. The durability problem still exists. It's that we've separated the durability problem from the lifespan of other resources in the system. Right. I can have a process that goes away, and that doesn't mean that I have to shoot the things that that process created. That's a separable decision. Conversely, I can have objects that I want to have a shorter lifespan than the process, and I might say, I will fabricate a separate storage pool for those. I will let that pool be used to allocate these short-lived objects, right? And I'll lap the pool to get rid of the objects, and the process may still be going. Like, the point here is that I want to make design decisions, intentional design decisions, about the lifespan of objects. And then one, not perfect, but natural place to do that is by talking about the lifespan of storage pools. And dealing with the lifespan of objects as an emergent effect that's a consequence of the lifespan of their storage pools. Now, there's a catch. Okay? So the good news about making policy decisions explicit and making resource decisions explicit is you now have a hope of managing them. The bad news is it often turns out that a consequence of making it possible to manage them is that you have made it necessary to manage them. Okay. And let me explain how that arises here. So, what does it mean now to destroy an object? Well, it could mean two things. It could mean I go to the object, maybe that object is a process, and I say to the process, be gone! Destroy yourself. Right? And the process tears itself down and does an orderly exit, whatever that means. And any service that process was providing is now gone. In fact, when the final part of the process goes, the capabilities to it get invalidated, and that is a destroy operation. The other thing I could do, is there a question there? The other thing I could do is I could go to the storage allocator, the pool, and say, destroy yourself, and reclaim all the storage you've handed out. Now we have an interesting problem. Okay. Because, of course, I could have a server that is running, and the storage that it occupies came from this storage allocator, which I'm now destroying. And so, a consequence of reclaiming that storage is, I'm going to destroy the server. So far, we're still okay. Either way, the server is going to be gone. If I do it by asking the server to go away, maybe it'll be gone in an orderly way. And if I do it by forcibly reclaiming the storage, it may be disorderly, but at least it's going to be gone. Or is it? Okay, there is a catch. The catch is, there's an assumption in that story that the server was built from a homogeneous source of storage. Suppose I have a server, that occupies 10 pages, and all those pages came from the same storage source, right? And when I shoot the storage source, all 10 pages are gone, life is good. Well, life at least is not confused. But suppose 5 of those pages came from one storage source, and 5 of those pages came from another storage source. And I shoot one of the storage sources, but not the other. This results in a very weird state. The service is not exactly destroyed, but it is unlikely to be functional. I mean, unlikely in the extreme, right? Suppose I took a Unix process, right, and I said, good, now we're going to delete every other code page, and whatever the thing can still do, it can still do. I mean, what's the likelihood that there's any sensible story that service still runs? You know, and more importantly, what's the likelihood that if it does happen to run, that you have any clue what it does or under what conditions it will fail? I certainly don't know. Okay, so the problem that comes when storage pools are first class is people have to now pay attention to what might be happening if they are commingling sources of storage whose lifetimes, whose temporal extents, are not the same. And one of the design patterns that emerges out of this in Eros is we actually work very, very hard never to do that. And the place where that's difficult, in practice, there appear to be two places where that's difficult. One is the case where I have a shared service responding to multiple clients. These clients do not necessarily trust each other. They're not necessarily collaborating with the service. This is a service that's part of the TCB for these clients. The service has to behave in a well-defined way. But if the service is going to do any allocation on behalf of a client, you really want it to use client storage. There's the catch. Take as an example a window manager, which it happens we built. So now what happens is the client goes and allocates a top level window. The bits for the window itself, it's not very hard to get those to come out of the client. However, somewhere in the server, right, there's a window data structure. And that data structure even can come out of client storage if you're really careful. But somewhere, you're going to have a collection of these window data structures. And these window data structures are going to go onto some kind of container collection structure. And that collection structure is going to be hooked together with pointers. And guess what happens if I whack the page out from under you? You now have a situation where you have a perfectly good window on the left with a pointer into a dead zone. And if you cannot successfully walk into that dead zone, you can't find the pointer to the next good window. This is really tough, and we don't have a general solution to it. There are a limited number of data structures that are friendly to having pieces ripped out from the middle. Okay, and this appears so far to be this place where, in a small way, we're going to have to violate the rule about global allocation, because we don't have a general solution to this problem. And I don't know of one in principle. I can tell stories about why this might not be an unreasonable thing to do. I can justify that allocation, but it makes me very unhappy. The second case where this issue appears, suppose Eric and I have a shared pool of files. We're collaborating on a project, okay? We have this pool of files. It's hard to imagine. We have this pool of files, and we both want to use them, okay? And at some point, Eric, you know, gets fired, right? Swarup thinks this is unlikely. He's laughing in the background.
No.
And, you know, when Eric gets fired, we delete his account. That's also unlikely. We delete his account, and his storage goes with it, right? And now what happens is every other page of these shared files would disappear, right? This would not be the end result that we were hoping for. So, one of the things that seems to happen when you have a shared source of storage is if you have a shared resource pool, the way you manage it is by creating for it a separate source of storage that we understand is shared. And part of what it means for Eric and I to collaborate in that space is we're agreeing as a matter of administrative policy that this is a storage pool from which either of us is free to allocate. And part of that is, at least in this domain of sharing, either of us can exhaust the resource. But the ability to exhaust the other guy's resource appears to be inherent in engaging in shared collaboration with bounds. Right? I don't know in principle of any way to avoid that. We have a second mechanism, which is we could say, hey, we'll let the storage be commingled, but before we fire Eric, right, we'll do a storage exchange protocol so that for those parts of objects that Eric was paying for the storage, I can agree that I'll pay for them from now on, right, and we'll do an exchange of pages, right, just like you and I could do a dollar swap. The problem with this is it assumes that, you know, when Eric's storage goes away, that this is the result of an orderly teardown process, and that this orderly teardown is actually going to give us a chance to do the dollar swap. In the real world, these teardowns are very rarely orderly. So the idea that I'll mix them up and I'll fix it later, so anytime you're designing a system and you hear the words, I'll fix it later, right? The answer is fire the designer and find a better one. Because it doesn't work in the real world. Okay. I'm going to pause and ask for questions, and I'm going to come back to this discussion tomorrow. What I want to point out here, though, is this issue of isolating durability and allocation from process lifespan turns out to be really important. The question I want to explore, start exploring tomorrow, is what are the patterns if two processes do not fully trust each other? What are the risks in their communications, and how can those risks be mitigated or managed? Online, the syllabus has been updated, and I understand that if I update the syllabus on Tuesday, I certainly don't get to ask you guys to have it all read by Monday of the same week anyway. Any of you who have a time machine are welcome to read the papers by yesterday. Failing that, I would appreciate it if you're not, you know, in desperate straits in your other courses. At least try to do a quick read tonight, please, of the IPC vulnerabilities paper, which is now online. And please try to have both of those two papers done by Monday of next week. But I want to talk about some of the IPC vulnerability issues tomorrow. And if you've had a chance to look at it, that would be helpful. And it's in the online syllabus. So, okay, questions about any of this? You see that this issue of managing storage is actually quite tricky, particularly when it becomes first class. I think the thing to say there is all of these problems, they exist whether the storage pools are first class or not. It's just now you actually get to pull them out into the light and look at them and enjoy how yucky they were. So, questions about any of this? Questions about midterm?
So my cousin is getting married.
Congratulations.
In California. So
in California.
One day. I won't be able to make
it. You won't be able to make it. Okay.
So can I just like email it to you or something?
Yeah, sure. look, if I were serious about time limits on this, right, I wouldn't be planning to give, you know, like an hour and a half midterm as a take-home thing, would I? There's one advantage to a take-home midterm, which is that, you know, you can sit with your beverage of choice as you do the midterm. Some of those beverages are technically not permitted into a Hopkins classroom without adult supervision. Okay, I saw a question over here.
Is there any material that can build upon this first class, the notion of first class?
No, not that I know of. It's a term that, as far as I can tell, came into the lexicon from the EI lab at MIT in the context of work on scheme. And to the best of my knowledge, the term came about when the idea of first class procedures was introduced. But I don't know how that term actually specifically came to be applied. And I don't actually know of any particularly good discussion about how to decide whether something is first class. It's a pretty informal notion. I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep. If you think you have the intuition, I wouldn't lose a lot of sleep over it. And I think the right intuition is, can I talk about one thing without necessarily talking about something else as well? Right? If I can talk about one thing in isolation from others, talk about in the sense that I can manipulate it as, you know, as a process performing operations.
Right.
Now we're arguing mechanism and details, but basically the thing is first class. Not sure that helps. They make it worse. Okay, other questions?
I had a brain fart when you were talking about Eros' strategy.
I hate when that happens.
Yeah.
Okay.
With dealing with durability of heterogeneous pages from the intervals. So what was it that Eros does to avoid issues from that?
You can't avoid issues from that, and the answer is don't do it.
Okay, so it just relies on services to
it, yeah, so a well-designed service doesn't commingle storage sources. Because once you go over that cliff, right, you're hanging at the end of a rope, okay, and you're waiting for Scott here to come along and saw it off. Okay. I'm gonna get you a little, you know, rope icon for next time.
Okay. I like the idea.
See, now we're back. We're back to cartoonists, you know. Okay. All right. We'll resume tomorrow.